All right, I'm Bill Nelson, director of the Sidney Kimmel Comprehensive Cancer Center at Johns Hopkins, and we're here today with two of our researchers trying to push the frontiers of this new avenue of cancer treatment, engaging the immune system to attack and destroy cancer cells, Mark Yarshwin and Alex Hopkins. And well, why don't we start out with what you've learned about some of the new treatments that are out there. They've been out there for a few years. They clearly appear to benefit some people and not benefit other people with cancer. And you guys have done a lot of thinking about this and pulled some data together, generated some insights. Why does this new immunotherapy work when it works and not when it doesn't?
Well, thank you for having us. Obviously, this new class of immunotherapy drugs, the immune checkpoint inhibitors, have really produced an unprecedented, I think, benefit for some cancers. And I think this is one of the most important questions right now is who are the patients who are benefiting from these drugs and who are the patients who are not benefiting from these drugs? And so, like many other people, we are working to try to come up with better biomarkers, tests that can figure out which patients are likely to benefit from these therapies. I think the best established biomarker right now is the expression of PD-L1 on the surface of tumor cells. PD-L1 is a marker that comes up on some cancer cells, and we think that cancers that have more PD-L1 are more likely to benefit from this new drug class, which is a PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitor. But actually, our research has taken us towards looking at a different biomarker, which is called tumor mutational burden, and I'm happy to talk a little bit more about that.
Well, I think if you take the general avenue is, you know, what is the immune system in place to do? It's there to survey the entire body in one way or another, looking for invasive organisms like bacteria and viruses. Viruses actually enter in cells and corrupt the cells themselves, so they want to distinguish virally infected cells. We know from experience that the immune system can distinguish, you know, let's say, a kidney from one person if it's not very well matched for the immune features when it's transplanted into a kidney from another person. So the immunologists like to say self, non-self discrimination generally. And one question is, can the immune system see cancer cells as different than normal cells? That is, can they view cancer cells as non-self? And this mutational burden seems to be a magical link in that direction. You know, Alex, is that what it is? When the cancers accumulate these mutations, they begin to look less and less like self?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think that you know, we definitely have developed over the last decades a view of cancer as a progressive disease that accumulates mutations over time, and there certainly seems to be a strong correlation between an increased number of mutations and the ability of the immune system to respond to these cancer cells, recognizing them, as you say, as non-self. The more mutations they accumulate, the more they're going to start looking like something foreign that the immune system can recognize.
Well, I have a actually fairly high-level scientific question for you both, because as you were describing this, it just sort of pinged on in my brain. But we know that cancers that can progress to threaten life start in a single cell at some point. As a cancer cell gets a defective gene, which may produce a protein product or something that the immune system can see is different in some way, there is a thought that the immune system can act at that point to eradicate that cell or prevent it from progressing. Some people call this immune editing. And that for a cancer to appear as a clinically significant entity, it needs to overcome this immune editing. You would think that a logical way to overcome it would be to not have so many mutations. So how do cells with so many mutations escape the immune system in the first place?
So that's a great question. And you know, several people have speculated about this. And one model that has come out is the model of the three E's. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but that cancer can go through basically three steps before it becomes a real problem and a true metastatic disease that is life-threatening. So the first step is elimination. We know that many cancers that start actually get destroyed by the body or eliminated. And then some cancers manage to not get eliminated and they start to grow, but initially they grow very slowly. And during this period of time, they reach kind of an equilibrium. So that's the second E, is equilibrium, where the body is constantly kind of attacking them, but the cancer is slowly growing. And during this period of time, and again, we don't know how long this period of time really lasts, we think that the cancer gets better and better at hiding from the immune system. And you asked a great question, which is how can the immune system hide if it has all these mutations that make it look so foreign from the immune system? Well, one of the things it does is it actually starts to shed mutations that it doesn't need. So if you look at a cancer over time, we think that actually one of the things it does is it takes the mutations that are coming along for the ride, called passenger mutations, and it slowly gets rid of them. So over time, the cancer actually gets fewer and fewer mutations, we think. At the same time, it's picking up new mutations that help it grow better, faster, or hide better. And then the other thing that it does is it learns how to co-opt the immune system. It finds ways of teaching the immune system that it's actually not foreign, that it's part of you, it's self. And one of the ways it does this is by basically taking things that the immune system uses to signal to itself and finds ways of doing that to kind of turn off the immune system. And one of these molecules is this PD-L1 molecule that I hinted at earlier, which is one way to kind of turn off the immune system. There's a famous case of a patient who died and was an organ donor, and several of the patient's organs were given to different people, so their kidneys went to different people. And then the people who got this patient's organs, all of them got cancer, got melanoma, type of skin cancer, shortly after the transplant. And they looked, and actually the melanoma in all the patients who got the transplant were all from the same donor. So basically cancer had come with the organs. And it turns out that the patient who had died, who was the organ donor, had a small melanoma that had been cut out many years earlier. But we think that all those years, even though the patient felt well before he died and was an organ donor, the cancer was kind of in an equilibrium state. And then it just escaped when it got transferred to the new patients. And that's the last stage, is escape, when the immune system finally gets turned off completely, or the cancer overcomes the immune system and really starts to grow out. So that's our model of how this happens.
So I'll throw a refinement question toward Alex. And so you talked about these so-called passenger mutations. That's sort of this concept that, in fact, actually, there's pretty good evidence at this point that every time one cell becomes two of the 3 billion base pairs that have to be reproduced with fidelity, there's lots of errors made. Most of them are corrected. Something like 5 to 10 sneak through each time. It's almost like a clock if you do enough sequencing. So that when we find mutations in cancers, many of them have arisen during this process. They may or may not have made the cancer a more successful growth machine as it assaults the body. They may have just been there when another, you know, mutation occurred. And this has been very challenging for people trying to discover which of the mutations are very important, right? Because you'll sequence, you find all the mutations, which of these are critical drivers of the cancer phenotype, which are so-called passengers. And best guess is 90% or more are actually passengers. I wonder if there's not another kind of quality, is that you begin to look at where these mutations are in the proteins. The way the immune system sees the mutants in the proteins makes some of these mutations more stimulating than others. Some of them, and how is that going to play out? Is our knowledge of how well a given protein mutation can be seen by the immune system in perhaps even in different people, is that to the point where we can say, you have a lot of mutations, these are passenger mutations, this fraction is incredibly appetizing to the immune system, Where are we with that kind of idea?
Yeah, so as you say, there is a significant background of passenger mutations, and one of the reasons that that happens is because often very early in cancers, a lot of the driver mutations for cancers will be in DNA repair genes. And so as these cells replicate, they actually accumulate more and more mutations because they don't have the ability to repair those mutations. And so I think one of the interesting things that we've learned recently with new technologies is that these tumors are not all each cell in the tumor is not identical. And that's what sets up this sort of Darwinian evolution that you're talking about, where the immune system can see certain cells which have certain mutations but not others.
So it's kind of like predator prey in a habitat.
Right, exactly, yeah. Exactly. And I think that very recently there's been a lot of work that is describing what you were just talking about, which is the idea that not all mutations are created equal, both in terms of what they do to the cancer cells, but also in terms of how it affects the immune system's ability to recognize it. And so we are increasingly aware that that mutations that lead to aberrant proteins that are very easily recognized by the immune system are actually frequently deleted by these mechanisms that Mark was talking about. And we're just now getting to the stage, I think, where we can take a personalized medicine approach, actually sequence the tumor from a patient and identify mutations that we think are likely to be targeted by the immune system. And that's really important for vaccine approaches, where we're actually trying to boost that response.
Well, so there's a question for you, which is exactly where I was hoping you would head, which is, if under the selective pressure, if you will, the immune system is a predator out there and the cancer is, you know, prey in some way, so the very strong appetizing things that the immune system recognizes, pressures to get rid of if they're not vital to being a cancer cell itself, but the ones that remain, these other passenger mutations, for which there are many, the notion is, can you build vaccinations? If you can use them to vaccinate, can you drive the immune system to recognize something that it intrinsically didn't want to eat before?
Yeah, so that's definitely the goal of a lot of these vaccine approaches, and there are many of them that have different sort of technical approaches to them. But that's certainly the idea, is to either introduce the immune system to an antigen, which is the molecule that it's recognizing on the tumor cell, either introduce it to an antigen that it's not familiar with in the hopes of boosting that response, or a lot of these other therapies, like Mark was talking about earlier, PD-1, these are designed to sort of generically take the brakes off of these immune systems so that they're just generally, the immune system becomes generally more aggressive towards tumors. Well, there's two different approaches.
I'll follow into Mark a little bit, is that if this is in play, you can, one of the things you'd hope in the setting of vaccination is that if there are immune cells that can recognize these antigens, that they're present and can be called into action. And yet there are some thoughts that for some critical immune cells that might recognize the cancer, that they have in fact mounted up a response and the cancer has thwarted it by one of these subterfuge means, and they are exhausted. They're there. They are wasted, lying on the sofa, unable to get into the game. Can they be recovered?
You know, I think that's the great question. There have been so many vaccine trials that have been done, and unfortunately, most of them have not been as successful as we would hope. In fact, despite decades of working on this, we really only have one vaccine that's approved for the treatment of cancer, not prevention of cancer, which is this prostate cancer vaccine. But, you know, the question is, why is it that all these vaccines have not worked as well as we would hope? And I think you are exactly right that these vaccines may help the body see the cancer, but ultimately the cancer is still outsmarting the immune system by putting up various barriers to the immune system. And so now people, including us, are working on ways of combining vaccines with other therapies that may make the immune cells continue to work and not get tired out. You know, I think that there's a lot of promise, but a lot more work has to be done to show that this is really possible.
Well, it does seem like there has been an evolution in the clinical research in this field as these new drugs, if you will, new antibody kind of drugs have come into play, which is to use them very early on in the course of an illness. And then as the person might undergo surgery to remove a cancer of one kind or another, look in at the cancer itself and try and figure out what it seems as if the immune system has done in response to this. And of course, many of the cancers we'd like to treat don't seem to have many immune cells sitting around. Some of the ones that make a lot of PD-L1, not all of them, but some of them seem to have a lot. That seems to be very promising. So they're sort of an already emerging goal. Can we get more immune cells to the point of attack? You all are participating in this kind of research. Where's that going to go, do you think?
I think Mark mentioned combination therapies, which is something that we're all, a lot of people are focused on. And the other sort of consideration with that is that I think the timing of these therapies is going to be really important. So certain therapies like a vaccine are designed to, you know, are designed to boost T cells with new specificities to recognize the tumor. And then other therapies are designed to help these T cells function, as you mentioned, once they get to the site of the tumor. And so I think in addition to combination therapies, I think there is going to be a lot more focus on the timing of these therapies so that you introduce these things in a logical order. So you expand T cells so that they can get to the tumor and attack, and then later maybe you come in with these checkpoint inhibitors that act on them later.
So if you look at the pathways that we're calling the immune checkpoint, there are many. At this point, the biopharmaceutical industry has, for lack of a better description, spray painted all of them with candidate drugs in one set of development or another. Is there going to be the two that are out there that have been targeted, the CTLA-4 and PD-1, PD-L1, they target both sides of it. Is there another one of these interactions that's going to be, that stands out in your mind as more promising than the rest? It may be just because it's sooner or further on in development, but is there another one that's more promising that you see?
I think it's a great question, but I think it's too early to really say, you know, there's so many other checkpoint molecules that are coming down the pike, things like LAG-3, which again, I think there's some data. Some patients who don't respond at all to PD-1 are having nice responses to LAG-3 inhibitors, so that's one that we're pretty optimistic about. You know, I think there are also numerous stimulatory checkpoints that are in development, things like 4-1BB, TIM-3, et cetera, et cetera, CD-40. But I think it's too early to know which one of these is really going to end up being successful. You know, I think one of the challenges that we have is that up to this point, the goal has been to turn on the immune system as much as possible. But we're starting to hit the kind of upper limit in terms of toxicity. The goal is to get the immune system to attack cancer. But as you turn on the immune system more and more, you have a higher and higher rate of the immune system getting confused and attacking self, and this is already a problem. We have many patients who attack their gut and get diarrhea, attack their skin and get a rash. And as we come up with more and more powerful immune modulators, these new immune checkpoint inhibitors, we're going to start running into more and more of this immune toxicity, I think. And this is going to be a real challenge, which is why I think one of the goals has to be to get the immune system to attack the cancer more specifically. And that's part of the reason why we and many others are still interested in vaccines. We think that vaccines are going to be important for targeting the immune system against the cancer.
So if you thinking about what we've learned, which I think you guys are going to argue is just the beginning of what we've learned about is going on in the area of a cancer with cancer cells, blood vessel cells growing in, mm-hmm. sort of support cells that are different in older people than in younger people, and all this kind of stuff, that there are so many dimensions to the way broadly the immune system sees foreign invaders. People call it innate and adaptive immunity and whatnot, that that there is some hints that some of the intrinsic immune responses that are present in cancers as they're growing are A, counterproductive, they may be aiding in metastasis, and B, suppress in some ways the immune responses that may eliminate the cancers. And there's starting to be a sort of a suite of drug ideas for that. These suppressing kind of elements, where do you guys think that's going?
I think up till now, the main focus has been working on CD8 T cells, which are one arm of the immune system. But I think you're right that the immune system has many different arms to it, and many of these arms may be important. And increasingly, there's a lot of interest in working on the innate immune system, which are a different arm of the immune system that can also be very powerful at eliminating cancer. And we're starting to see some of these early molecules in development, things like CD47, chemokines. I don't know how that's all going to shape out, but I think that it's certainly a promising area, and we'll have to see where that goes.
Yeah, and a strong immune response in the case of an infection, and sort of the classical immune context, involves all stages of the innate and adaptive immunity to be a really strong response. And I think it's becoming increasingly clear that that's going to be the case in cancer immunotherapy as well, that we can't just target CD8 T cells. We need help from CD4 T cells. We need B cells there as well to really get a strong immune response.
Well, I was very intrigued by one of the mouse models for cancer taken on by Gerard Evan. He published a paper last fall, and I've seen some of the evidence he's collected subsequently, where they drive a cancer in a mouse with a very specific sort of cancer-causing gene that they can toggle on and off. That's the way the experiment works. And sure enough, you toggle on this gene, the cancer gets big and it metastasizes, and it's very bad. The most interesting thing is when he toggled on the behavior of this cancer driver gene, the T cells in the tumor left, and macrophages, another kind of innate type immune response, showed up within hours. And then when he toggled it off, the T cells all came back. And it gets to something, Mark, you were saying earlier, that cancers, to overcome whatever the initial immune barriers are, practice some kind of subterfuge, and they seem to be, unfortunately, very clever about undermining or creating divisiveness in the immune response in some way. And it comes sort of full circle that some of these drivers may actually be driving their ability to get around the immune system, not just driving their ability to grow a lot, which you might be able to do in a dish away from the immune system. The immune system's important to every component of the cancer forming.
No, I think that's a great point. Is, you know, up to this point, we've really focused on tumorigenesis as being a growth phenomena and an energy phenomena, but actually immune evasion is one of the first things that a cancer does as it forms, figures out how to escape the immune system. And in fact, many of the early cancer genes directly affect the way that the cancer interacts with the immune system. You can take even a precancer and find evidence that it's figuring out how to hide from the immune system. So this is going to be very important. And I think many of the combination approaches that people are working on now, ways to combine immune checkpoints with other therapies, are actually focusing on how do we modulate the cancer? How do we make the cancer not as good at hiding from the immune system by shutting down particular things inside of the cancer that help it hide? One of the projects that we're working on is actually looking at targeted therapy, something that was developed actually to slow cancer down as a growth phenomena, but actually we're finding that when we give it to cancer cells, it doesn't have much of an effect on slowing the cancer down, but it takes away the cancer's ability to hide. And I think that many of the drugs that we think of as being targeted therapies, things that were developed really to slow down the rate of growth of the cancer, are actually more important in terms of taking away the cancer's ability to subvert the immune system. So I think we're living in the era of immunotherapy, and many of our targeted therapies are actually very powerful immunotherapies, and we have to revisit them.
I think that's a therapeutic sort of convergence with what Gerard mm-hmm. Eben have seen. If the yep. driver cancer gene also affects the immune system, then using a drug antagonist of this driver gene ought to have immune benefits. And exactly. you're saying there are already some evidence that there is. I'll throw another thought at you guys. Now that we have some treatments out there that are working, of course, inevitably in the cancer business, something works for some period of time, and a few people that benefit is not live long enough, and the cancer grows despite this maneuver. I actually engaged in a very spirited conversation a number of years ago with one of the premier ecologists in the world, Daniel Botkin. He's an interesting character. And he had personal experiences with cancer, and this is, we were at some kind of a think tank. And he suggested that, you know, the use of cytotoxic chemotherapy was destined for failure from the perspective of an ecologist, right? And he said, well, it's like using a pesticide, right? You introduce it, the targeted, organism, in this case, what always happens is it goes down, and then it always escapes in its resistance to the pesticide. And you guys think about cancer the way I do. He says, does this ever happen in cancer? I said, yes.
Right. All the time.
Almost yeah. all the time. So you have
Except
my attention.
Except for testicular cancer, right?
And he says, and I don't get this, you guys are waiting for immune therapy. I don't understand how that's going to work either. He says, that's like putting a predator in. You know, you put in some lizard to eat the mosquitoes, and almost always what happens is the mosquitoes go down, the lizards go down, and then what happens is the mosquitoes overswamp the lizards on yep. the back end. So you get resistance there too. Well, we've seen some resistance to these yep. immune checkpoint inhibitors, and there's been very deliberate attempts to try and characterize why. Are there any themes emerging in your guys' mind as to why it works for a while and then it doesn't work?
Well, this is a very hot area of research, as you know. There's at least two forms of resistance to immunotherapy. There's primary resistance, where you give the drugs and nothing happens, and then there's secondary resistance, where you see this beautiful response, just like introducing lizards against mosquitoes, and then eventually the mosquitoes come back. And a lot of effort is going on now to try to figure out, you know, how is the cancer coming back and eventually escaping the immunotherapy. A number of different things seem to happen. One of them is that the cancer can actually lose the mutation that the body was relying on to recognize it. So if there's a mutation that's there for the ride, that's in 99% of the cancer cells, that one cell that doesn't have that mutation is not going to be seen by the immune system, and it will turn into
its own
cancer.
And this goes back to this genetic instability kind of thing that Alex was talking about. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I think the predator and pesticide analogy is really perfect, actually, because we tend to think of these immunotherapies as having an advantage over traditional targeted therapies mm-hmm. because the immune system is also able to adapt. Whereas, in the pesticide example, you're putting one molecule out there and hoping that it kills everything. So that's sort of one of the things that we see as an advantage for immunotherapy, is that the tumor can adapt, but so can the immune system.
So just to finish up other forms of secondary resistance, in some cases we think that the immune system actually just kind of tires out. And this, we call this exhaustion, and actually many different drugs are being developed now to try to keep the immune system going that might work with an immune checkpoint inhibitor. And then also we know that the cancer can find other ways to hide from the immune system by upregulating other molecules that can turn off the immune system, or finding new ways to hide from the immune system. So we know that cancer is constantly showing itself to the immune system through something called HLA. These are ways that the immune system sees what the cancer is, and the cancer can find ways to turn that off, that process off.
Yes, using the cloaking device that always seemed to work in Star Trek.
Exactly.
I have
good analogy.
I have a last one for you guys to speculate on, and I think a lot of people are beginning to ponder these kinds of questions. So, in the wonderful history of how we've started to build successes in treating cancer, you have this heroic attempts to deliver cytotoxic chemotherapy to treat children with acute lymphocytic leukemia. You have these sort of combination, mostly empirically discovered cytotoxic drugs that cured Hodgkin's disease in many people, seminomas and whatnot. Knowing what you know about cancers generally and the difficulty that we've had eradicating advanced cancers of other kinds, how did we ever cure those other cancers? And I forget the full-on speculation. How was the immune system plausibly involved in the way we empirically cured Hodgkin's disease, ALL, testicular cancer?
Great question. you know, we've always, a lot of people have assumed that we've done all the hard work with our chemotherapies, but obviously eradicating the root of the cancer is going to involve an immune response. And so I think one theory is that the therapies that we've been giving get rid of 99.9% of the cancer cells. But as those cells die, they show what they are, and the immune system learns from their death and might go and take care of those last couple of cells. So, you know, I think a good sort of theoretical question is, if we didn't have an immune system, would we ever be able to eradicate cancer? I think no, but we'll never know the answer to that question.
Well, that's sort of borrowed from the antimicrobial antibiotic kind of theory, that yeah, there's a manageable amount of bacteria, or in this case, mm-hmm, cancer cells the immune system can deal with. Yep. Beyond that, it can't. So you got to get it into that range. What do you think, Al?
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. We've definitely learned that traditional therapies, chemotherapy, but also radiation, you know, can act synergistically with immunotherapy, because a dying tumor cell can act as a vaccine to prime the immune system. But another edge to that sword, which is that these traditional therapies a lot of the time kill rapidly dividing cells,
including the immune cells.
So that's sort of you know, why that's not always observed.
If I can just make one more comment, you know, a lot of people have been focusing on so-called rational combinations, where they combine two drugs that seem to work synergistically. You know, in some ways, I'm more interested in irrational combinations, because if you have two drugs that each get rid of 99% of the cancer cells and you put them together, you're actually going to get rid of, you know, 99% of the 1% that are left by the other cells. So you're left with very, very few cells. And that may be good enough. So, you know, people want to combine two immune drugs together, or two targeted drugs that seem to help each other out. But maybe it's time to start thinking about, how do we combine two drugs that have nothing to do with each other, but each mop up 99% of the cancer? That may be an interesting approach, as long as the drugs don't interfere with each other.
So as long as the treatments can get out of their own way,
exactly,
we can combine them in more productive ways. And I think, this is Bill Nelson. As we come to a close, I think what you're hearing is the immune system is going to be a vital component of the cancers that, of the cure for cancers that we achieve in the future. It's increasingly benefiting more and more people. And with a little bit more work, I think we're going to continue to see the growth in its effectiveness over time.